This evening we'll continue with the subject of thoughts that come from the right. You'll remember that we were together on this a long while ago. We gave three talks prompted by a verse from Psalm 90, which says, 1,000 shall fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand. And that gave us the opportunity to speak about many things that can deceive a person in one way or another, because there aren't only falls on the left. There are also falls on the right. Falls from the right are the ones that go unnoticed and do not even reach holy confession, the sins that arise from a fall on the right. We said a great deal about this, and from the many discussions that took place afterward and eventually reached my ears, I learned that many people were edified. They had truly been deceived. Many opinions they held and many efforts they had made were mistaken. For this reason, people who fear God and desire salvation, people who fear the wiles of Satan, who appears as an angel of light, always take care, before making a decision or taking an action, to seek the counsel of someone with spiritual discernment and grace. That person may be a clergyman, but often he may also be someone outside the clergy. There are people who possess this gift of discernment. There are also people who fear the wiles of Satan and, moved by humility, ask for counsel. They do what spiritual people used to do. Although they lived in ascesis and withdrew from the crowds, they would often go out into the desert to find someone from whom they could hear a word. They did not go to confess, they already had someone for holy confession, but to hear something more, some word filled with discernment. Many have wept over it afterward, and if their pride allowed them to admit it, they would say so. It happened because they did not ask for counsel. They followed their own reasoning. They did not disclose their logismos, the intrusive thought, to discern whether it came from the good or from the evil one. They did not take heed of the wiles of Satan or of his long experience. If a person remembered that he was dealing with an enemy who has nearly 8,000 years of experience, he would not dare to make decisions so easily. He would consider everything and be careful about everything. Through what we said in those three talks, many people recognized numerous mistakes of their own, which they resolved to correct and put in order through metanoia and holy confession. And so, this evening, I have several more things to say about these right-hand logismoi. One thing that often deceives a person concerns making a vow. I do not know whether this has ever concerned you. I vowed this, or I have a vow to fulfill, or he had made a vow, or he made a promise. Many people do not want to acknowledge that a vow is binding. Yet Holy Scripture itself says, "Make your vows and fulfill them to the Lord our God." A person may make a vow. This does not mean that God needs the vow, or that a saint needs a vow or a promise. Yet, for the sake of the weak, God has allowed people to make use of what we call a vow. And when a person makes a vow, he is obliged to fulfill it. Sadly, many people make vows and receive what they asked for. Yet they do not fulfill their vow. Perhaps there are people in this audience who made a vow many years ago. Some made a vow at the battlefront, others in a difficult moment, during an illness, for their child, for their wife or husband, and so forth. Yet afterward, they did not fulfill what they had promised. They are bound. No one can loose them. Not a confessor, not a bishop, not a patriarch. If every epitratulion in the world, every priest's stole, were gathered together, they still would not loose them. That vow will have to be fulfilled. Only the judgments of God can resolve such cases. You should have thought carefully before making the promise. Then a right-hand logismos comes from Satan and says, "But does God really need your vow, as we said before? You only said it because you were in desperate need. Surely God is not going to hold you to that now. This is a right-hand logismos. It leads you astray, deceives you, steals your time, and makes the whole matter more complicated." Someone may ask, "What do you mean more complicated?" Let me tell you about one such case. A mother whose child was ill made a vow to Saint Nicholas in Achaia, whose feast is celebrated there on the 8th of May. She vowed that if her child recovered, she would carry the child on her shoulders to the saint's shrine. The shrine was, of course, 30 or 40 kilometers from her village. The child was small then, and the child recovered. But even to this day, she has not taken the child there because of various logismoi, and today the child weighs 40 kilograms. So many years have passed while Satan kept deceiving her with today and tomorrow. The child grew and became so heavy that she can no longer carry him on her shoulders. Can a woman now carry 40 kilograms for 40 kilometers? It would take her a week to get there. Yet this is her vow, and it still awaits fulfillment. Some right-hand logismos, I do not know which one, deceived her. And to this day she has not taken the child. This is why a person must exercise great care when making a vow. The vow may perhaps seem strange. Just now a note has been brought to me from behind. I see little Lefteris here, and Lefteris has reminded me of something. It may seem strange to you. Does the saint really need me to bring a candle as tall as I am, or the oil I vowed, or an icon, or whatever else it may be? That is not the point, as the incident the boy has reminded me of clearly shows. In the mountains of Evrytania, there was an elderly woman, about 80 years old, who had suffered from a stomach ailment for 20 years. The poor woman would curl up in pain, and because she had no means, none of the remedies available to her could make her well. She did not have the money to go to a doctor. But every summer, as you know, people would pass through on their way to Prusos, to the shrine of our most holy Theotokos there. So she too made a vow, "My most holy Theotokos, make me well, and I will bring you the straps from my Zerushia." She had nothing else to offer. "Make me well, and I will bring you the straps from my Zerushia." Do you know what those straps are? They are the laces, as we would call them, used to tie the traditional shoes. That was her vow. The elderly woman was healed that very night. You can imagine her joy. Meanwhile, she waited for August 23rd, when people would be going to the feast there, so that she could join them, since she did not know how to make the journey by herself. The hens were gone. During the summer, someone came to the village and stayed there for a while. The woman sold a little milk, gathered a small amount of money, and decided to alter her vow. She thought it was too humble a gift to bring the straps from her Sarushia, so she bought a small, inexpensive icon from a traveling merchant. To her, of course, it was something precious. She intended to offer that instead as her vow, and to thank the Lady Theotokos for what she had done for her. So she went with the other pilgrims, venerated at the shrine, left her offering there, and returned home. But on the very night of her return, the same illness came back, even worse than before, as we say. It was as though the roof had fallen in on her. She was utterly stunned. She began to search her conscience and ask where she had gone wrong. "What have I done? Why has she taken away the grace of healing? I brought what I had promised and something even better." Then our most holy Theotokos appeared to her and said, "I have withdrawn your healing until you bring the offering you actually vowed. I have no need of an icon. You must bring the straps from the Sarushia that you promised me." And the grandmother found a way once again to take the straps from the Zeruchi, the traditional shoe. And the grandmother got well again, and she died a good death. At about 95 years old, she lived another 15 years, 15 more years she lived. So it isn't a matter of the saint needing to receive this thing or that one in order for the miracle to be granted on his part. No, the point is this: that is what you vowed, and you must be faithful to what you vowed. Do not allow yourself to be deceived. I recently learned of another incident, and I'm waiting to see how it turns out. A man just a few days ago, faced with his wife's illness, a rare illness that no doctor knew what to say about, made a vow to the Panagia of Tinos, if she would make his wife well, he would take her to Tinos by boat, under sail. And remarkably, once he had entrusted her to the Lord of Lords, the physician of physicians, the woman was healed. If that seems hard for anyone to believe, there are witnesses to this case. It happened just now, 20 days ago, 30. So now what is this man going to do? He is going to take her under sail to Tinos. That is a hard thing to carry off. With a little boat with a motor on it, I can understand that. but to find a fair wind with your sail carrying you the whole way, all the way to Tenos, that is a bit difficult. Yet he must fulfill his vow. Now the seemingly righteous thought will begin to come, and it will keep coming. But will he have the strength to resist it? I do not know whether God will withdraw his grace and permit the illness to return, but the man will lose his soul. The boat is ready, and I believe that the voyage will be guided safely. If he dares to undertake it, he will be guided safely. People cross oceans with nothing but a little sail. The Most Holy Theotokos will help her, and she will arrive. So, as I was saying, there are people who, through seemingly righteous thoughts and their own reasoning, have failed to fulfill many promises made during difficult moments in their lives. They received what they asked and longed for, yet their vows remain unfulfilled to this day. They should take very seriously the fact that they made a promise, that they made a vow, saying that it was made in a moment of terrible difficulty changes nothing. At that very moment, you believed there was someone more powerful than you. How can you now treat that person as though he were powerless? The proof that he truly is more powerful is that he gave you what you had asked for, something that medical science, your own efforts, money, time, and everyone else were unable to give you. How can you disregard that now and fail to fulfill what you promised? There is the well-known case of the man who vowed that, if he returned alive from Albania, he would go on his knees from the harbor all the way to the Church of the Most Holy Theotokos on Tenos. He passed through a terrible ordeal and was miraculously saved, yet to this day he merely keeps repeating that he will fulfill the vow. And to this day, about 35 years have passed, and he has still not fulfilled it. Nor is this the only case. There are countless other cases like it. Other people have vowed different things. Some have promised to become clergy, but then supposedly more mature thoughts, right-hand thoughts, came to them. Is becoming a clergyman the only way to thank God? If someone becomes a Christian, raises a Christian family, and brings up Christian children, is that not better? Why should he become a clergyman? Or why should he become a monk? He finds countless other ways to avoid fulfilling his vow. If you look in Deuteronomy, you will find many passages about this. No one told you to make a vow. No one forced you. You yourself considered it and said it. That settles it. Now you must fulfill it. Many people therefore look for excuses, prompted by other right-hand thoughts. But the matter is clear and allows no debate, especially when the vow was made to the Lord God. Mothers should take care to remember what they have vowed, and so should young men, young women, husbands, wives, and everyone else. Whatever we have promised, God requires it for our own sake, so that we may cease being liars and inconsistent, and escape the place where Satan has caught us and holds us through thoughts from the right. Many people, if they seek the cause of the misery in their lives, may find it in something they promised but never fulfilled, or in the path they took because of it. The voice that cried out through John the Forerunner will always cry out, "It is not lawful for you. What you have done cannot be forgiven." That voice is waiting for the promise to be carried out. And so if you open the Pedalion, the rudder of the Church's canons, and look up the canons of St. Basil the Great in particular, which deal with matters like these, you will find them very demanding, and a person needs someone of great discernment if he is ever going to find rest. For he cannot find rest while he remains guilty before his conscience, before the Lord, and before the laws of the Lord. Yet Satan has many ways of drawing a person away again. Someone may say, "I made a promise and I fulfilled it." Be careful even after you have fulfilled what you promised. Satan will not leave you in peace. He has experience, malice, and hatred, and he will strive with all his might to draw you away and bring you back into his hands. I remember one case. I met a young woman who was educated, and when I say educated, I mean she held a university degree. She had promised to become a nun, but later on, because of various relatives of hers there, in the end she did not become a nun. For a time at least she did not. She went out into the world. She took her degree. She began to work. but she could find no rest. She had come to a crossroads. We talked the whole matter over. I laid it all out on the table for her, exactly as it stands written down on paper. Everything we find in the experience of the fathers, and what Elder Lake says. I brought her face to face with her conscience and with her vow to God. It is true that not long afterward, she left everything, departed, and entered a monastery. But I remember saying this to her, "Be careful, even where you are going, you will not be left alone. The one who had the power to keep you away from your promise for 14 whole years will follow you there indeed, he will arrive before you." "But what can he do to me?" she asked. "Once I am there," I said, "he will do something you do not expect. Once you arrive, he will tell you, 'You were not meant to come here.' These women are uneducated, while you are educated. I could understand your going somewhere else, establishing something of your own, becoming the abbess yourself, and educating others. But to remain with women who grumble among themselves, who do not even know how to say thank you, mercy, or forgive me, pardon, why would someone like you go there?" "I don't believe it will come to that," she said, "but it did come to that, and she left the monastery unable to go on living there. Yet she returned to the monastery, and now she is at peace and has succeeded." "How did she succeed, you ask? Do you know? Let me tell you how she succeeded, so that you too may keep it in mind. This happens to many people. They do not find the atmosphere in their office good. They do not find the atmosphere at work good. They do not find the atmosphere wherever else they may go. They want to find angels while they themselves are difficult for others to live with." "But why should you only receive and not give? I understand that. Surely Holy Scripture says, 'It is more blessed to give than to receive.' Why do you go looking only to receive to find sanctified people without giving anything yourself? How do you know whether God wants you there so that through your virtue, patient endurance, and prayer, you may offer something to them and at the same time become better yourself? There is no particular merit in becoming better when you live among people more advanced than you." "That is only natural. But to become better while living among those who are beneath you, that is the great achievement." So I reminded her gently, of course, of what happened in the ark. Would those people have been saved in the ark if they had not shown patient endurance and accepted that they had to live together with the animals for 6 whole months? Amid the stench, amid the roaring of the wild beasts and all the rest, they nevertheless lived for 6 whole months and they were saved and came out alive. Otherwise they would have drowned. It is the same here. We are among wild beasts. This is an ark. Did we come here expecting to find angels? But the bad person is certainly no reason for you to lose your temper. Is that any kind of reason? The bad person becomes the very occasion for you to become even better. Don't you know that? It all depends on this. It depends on me. It depends on me. Because by living close to someone who is evil, I can become good. Many people look for better people around them so that they themselves may become good and attain holiness. They want to become holy, but they say others will not let us. Yet who will bring this about? The very people who will not leave you in peace, those are the ones who will sanctify you if you truly want to attain holiness. But we fail to notice this, and we are always looking for saints. So, when we were discussing this subject, I said, "Tell me, what if Noah's children, or Mr. and Mrs. Noah themselves, had said to God, 'We are not staying in here with all these animals, with the crocodiles, with the—'" And then there was the filth and everything else. Surely you do not imagine that they had perfumes, baths, and detergents in those days, so that they could wash everything properly. There was filth and a terrible stench, yet they were compelled to remain together inside, and thus they were saved. So do not be deceived, and do not let a thought persuade you to leave. For once it draws you away from your appointed place, it will also draw you away from your proper way of life. This is what happens. St. Basil the Great says, so many people fail to take heed of this. They become miserable and are deceived wherever they go afterward because they think that they have fulfilled their vow although they have not put down roots where they were first planted. Think. then, reflect and examine yourselves. In case you too have become entangled in such matters, do you understand? While each of us is still breathing, we have an opportunity to examine ourselves. The fact that the body still lives is God's assurance that He is waiting for us to put in order those things which, for one reason or another, we have neglected until today. I shall now turn to another matter in which the right-hand thought is also at work and has brought many people crashing down. As I have told you before, the aim of the right-hand thought is to blaspheme the Lord, either directly or indirectly. To blaspheme means to damage someone's good name, to say that God does not provide for us, that He is not good, and so on. This is the aim of the seemingly righteous thought, to shift the blame onto God. Let me turn to the subject of illness, which naturally troubles us both in our own lives and in the lives of others. Suppose I am religious. The thought plants its suggestion in my nous and says, "Why should you fall ill? I can understand a sinner falling ill. I can understand those other people falling ill. But you glorify His name from morning until night. You are careful, you confess, you fast, you raise children, and you do everything in His name. Is God not unjust?" And why do those who blaspheme Him, who do not believe and never go to church, never seem to fall ill? Everything goes well for them. They have health, joy, festivities from morning until night, cruises and all the rest. Is God not unjust? At this point, we need the restraining power of the gospel. Such logismoi are found not only among the sick. Because we are wretched, they are found even among strong and healthy people. You see how far this can go. You begin complaining against God. The simple soul says to Him, "Do you not hear? Did you not make our ears? Did you not make our eyes? Do you not see those who insult you and refuse to believe in you?" Jeremiah expressed this complaint in chapter 12, verse 1. Why does the way of the ungodly prosper? Why do all who deal treacherously flourish? You planted them. Indeed, they have taken root. They grow. Indeed, they bear fruit. This is the complaint of many people. It is widespread. How often we ask, "What have I done to God?" Or we say about someone else, "Why did this happen to him?" If I ask this about myself out of humility, I understand I am a sinner. That is one thing. But then I ask why Panagopoulos, for example, he labors in God's vineyard. Why does God not make everything go well for him? These are seemingly righteous thoughts. To us they appear justified, but they imply that God has made a mistake. God does not make mistakes. God knows what He is doing. He knows why He shows long-suffering toward one person and why He tightens the reins on another, so to speak. There is wisdom in it. There is instruction, prevention, and love. I will put before you a question you know from school. Among the many parables we learned there was the parable of the fool, the rich fool. It says, "The land of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. Was God unjust?" Listen to it again. The rich man's land produced a good harvest. If a poor man's land produces a good harvest, glory to God. But if it's a rich man's land that produces a good harvest, does that make God unjust? He can't get his mind around it. So what should God do? Strike the man down on the spot. He's convinced that a blow always brings a person back and makes a believer out of him. Go and read the 16th chapter of Revelation and see what it says. When God struck them with the plagues, it says, they gnawed their tongues and blasphemed God. I remember, and I have told you this before, what happened when the earthquake struck Kefalonia. I wrote to several people there, including a friend whom I had met while he was a patient at Soteria Hospital. He was a good family man. I asked how things were, and he replied, "We had two houses, Mr. Panagopoulos, as I told you last year when we were together at Soteria. Today, however, we are living beneath an awning, under a piece of canvas. Both houses have been leveled, but that is not the real issue," he told me. "Nor am I grieved that we are living like this. We will build another house. What grieves me is that my father, even under the tent, still blasphemes Christ. Do you understand?" The land of a certain rich man yielded plentifully, it says. God knows why. It is as though He says, "Let me give you so much that you have nowhere to store it, so that you may be compelled to give some away and come to know the joy of giving. I say this especially for certain men and women. Oh, if only God would send my husband an illness. Oh, if only he would give him a good slap. But God knows whether he should give him that slap or permit an illness. What if it only makes him harder and casts him farther away from paradise? We have not studied these things. And through these supposedly righteous and good logismoi, when we want the world, our daughter-in-law, or anyone else to return to the right path, we reach the point of speaking to God as though we could advise him. So we too have an opinion to offer him. And this is a very funny thing, and a very self-centered one for a person to believe that they can do such a thing. Know this as well. God does not sustain a person or give him health simply because that person is attentive to God and reveres him. At times God takes these things away. It is a satanic thought to believe that a person can enter into a transaction with God. He gives to God so that he may receive. This is exactly what the devil reminded God of when he was speaking about Job. He said to him, "Job does not fear you for nothing. He has a reason. He has an interest, and that is why he fears you. You keep watch over him. You guard him. That is why he fears you. Stretch out your hand and let me strike him, and you will see whether he does not blaspheme you to your face." But afterward it was proved that Job did not revere God because God gave him blessings. Rather, because Job revered him, God gave him those blessings. God's giving did not come first. Job's reverence and love came first. The proof is that when his family, his wealth, his livestock, and everything else slipped from his hands, he still did not blaspheme. From now on, then, let us not demand this of other people or of God, and let us not tell God what he ought to do. Whatever he permits, let us receive it. When something happens, I will examine it within myself. Why has this happened? What do you want to teach me? Why are you taking me by the ear? Why do you allow this? What do you want to remind me of? Where am I falling short? Please help me to correct it. If I discover where I am at fault, then I should correct it. Since that may be the reason God permitted this chastening, this sorrow, this failure, this or that loss, and so forth. Let us never blame this person or that person, and above all, let us never blame God. God always acts rightly, though our minds cannot comprehend his ways. Let us never be quick to open our mouths and accuse God's providence or God's love. I remember a very devout young man who once worked aboard a large merchant ship. His parents were certain that, because their son had such faith in God, no harm would ever come to him, even if the ship itself were lost. Yet the time came when they grew resentful toward God. They received a telegram from New York saying that their son was there with both legs broken. As he was coming down from the upper deck of the ship, the stairs being completely vertical, he slipped and fell, breaking both his legs. His injuries were so severe that, although the great ship had a fully equipped hospital on board, they were forced to leave him behind for treatment. They could not take him with them, so he had to remain there. When his family here saw the telegram, they took the news of his injury and its severity to mean that he had died. At first, they did not believe that this was all there was to it. They thought, "They are breaking it to us little by little. The boy has died," and so on. And so they began accusing God. Why had God permitted this young man, who believed in him so deeply, to suffer such harm? Perhaps he had died. Perhaps he had suffered something that would leave him disabled, or perhaps he would remain bedridden for a very long time before recovering. About 10 days passed from the hospital. The young man sent them another telegram to reassure them, and so they came to believe that he really was alive. But the mother, above all, had become bitter against God because he had allowed this to happen. Meanwhile, the ship continued on the rest of its voyage. The day after it departed from New York, it caught fire and burned with all hands lost. No one was saved. When the parents read in the newspapers that the ship had burned, they swallowed their accusing words. Then they preferred to have their son alive with broken legs and in plaster casts, rather than burned to ashes or devoured by sharks in the Atlantic. Do not point an accusing finger. Examine yourself deeply and honestly, ask for God's grace, and search as though with a magnifying glass to find every detail, where the fault lies and where you yourself have gone astray. There is always a particular reason why something happens, unless, as is so often the case, we ourselves have ruined things and are ourselves the cause. Back when Tay still existed, before Olympic Airways, God had left a certain widow with one child, a girl, a very beautiful girl with a lovely figure. Various relatives promoted the idea that she ought to become an actress, appear on the screen, move audiences, win the admiration of the world, and earn a great many dollars as well. After graduating from what was then called the School of Fine Arts, she received a scholarship to Italy. She would study there for 2 years and then return, with everything prepared for her future, as you understand. The next morning she was to depart from Ellinikon Airport. The alarm clock rang that morning, but she was found lying paralyzed in bed. You can imagine what followed. Her mother began accusing everyone from the heights of heaven to the depths of the earth, blaspheming and cursing everyone. She could not see God's hand in what had happened. She could not see her own error, or how her daughter had been heading almost 100% toward destruction. Do you understand? Instead of going to Ellinikon Airport, the girl went to the nearby Asclepieion Hospital in Vula. She remained paralyzed for 7 months. No treatment had any success. A group of our young people from the Christian Corner used to visit her there. They would go there and they would talk, and she began to hear things she had never heard before, that God exists. Her mother wanted the Most Holy Theotokos to protect her in her artistic success. The mother had turned the Most Holy Theotokos into an agent for her daughter's career, someone merely to work for her and serve her purposes, not someone to venerate. The daughter now began to come to her senses and to see that perhaps the hand of God had brought this about to keep her from becoming what she was about to become, and she began to speak to her mother, indirectly but firmly, "If you repent and believe that the hand of God brought me here, I will be able to rise again. The doctor knows nothing at all. Whether I will ever stand again, nothing. Everything remains uncertain." Much more time passed, and the aunt still did not believe it. At times she believed, and at other times she did not. Caught between pride, fear, necessity, and all the rest, the mother finally showed that she had repented. She acknowledged the truth and went to confession. It was just before Pascha, on the Saturday before Pascha, that is, on Holy Saturday. She took a candle and a loaf of soreki and went down to see her daughter. She intended simply to leave them there and return, but the child was waiting for her at the door. She had gone only to leave the child the sweet bread and the candle, and the child took them and came inside the house. They got the discharge papers on Monday. On Tuesday, I don't know exactly when the doctor gave it. We ourselves don't know how. Something is taking place. There is a particular reason for it. Has someone been deceived? Who is this person? He may even be a saint. The fact that he suffers proves nothing to the contrary. Moreover, you should know this. The fathers say that a person who suffers in bed without murmuring receives a martyr's crown. And I would even dare to say that his crown may be greater and of a finer quality than that of a martyr, especially if the illness is long-lasting and his endurance remains without reproach. For the martyr faced his trial for 1, 2, or 3 hours, perhaps for a day or two. But to the person lying ill, Satan comes day and night and says, "Where is God?" It takes great strength, great patient endurance, and great humility for a person to answer him and say, "Get behind me, Satan." That is why the fathers acknowledge that a person who suffers from a long illness yet continually says, "Glory to you, O God," receives a martyr's crown. On this subject there are 1,000 cases and more that could be told. For tonight I would like just one talk. I don't know what else will come up. I would like to read to you about a right-hand thought, a seemingly good thought of a holy man who descended even to the depths of Hades and whose feast our church celebrated last month, specifically on the 27th. This concerns a saint who possessed, I would say, an inborn gift of hospitality. But someone else intervened and caused great harm both to that saint and to another man. Yet God, the lover of mankind, and the most holy Theotokos, God-bearer, intervened in time and saved them both. Still, a great lesson was left for all those who think they know better than God himself. For this right-hand thought went beyond what was visible. Beyond that God holds us in his hand, I shall relate the account word for word, together with a few explanations from the Synaxarion. On this day, April 27th, Saint Eulogios the Hospitable reposed in peace. Once, Abba Daniel set out from Cetus, taking his disciple along with him as his companion. Abba Daniel and his disciple set out, and they went down to Alexandria. They stood in the marketplace throughout the day, waiting for the Lord to send them help. They remained there, confident that God would send someone to take them in and offer them hospitality. They see an old man walking along, about 90 years old, carrying a lantern. He was out looking for the poor and for strangers. He would go around the streets and alleys, checking the benches and so on, and anyone he found with nowhere to sleep, with nothing to eat, he would bring to a room he kept for that purpose. This man would take them in and offer them hospitality in his own home. When he saw Abba Daniel, he bowed before him. As soon as he saw that he was a monk, he bowed down and, weeping, warmly kissed his feet. A monk is a person of great dignity, holding the prayer rope in his hand, and a clergyman is a person of great dignity, for he brings heaven down to earth and raises the earth up to heaven. After greeting them, he took them together with the other strangers and poor people whom he had gathered from the marketplace and the benches into his home. There, according to his custom, he washed their feet and offered them generous hospitality. And whatever pieces of bread were left over, he gave to the dogs and they ate them, all the leftovers from the loaves. For that was the vow he had made, the promise he had given, to keep nothing back for tomorrow. Tomorrow will bring what belongs to tomorrow. After supper, they spoke together throughout the night, exchanging words that brought spiritual benefit, and Eulogios, the man who was offering them hospitality, wept out of his deep catanixes, his compunction and reverence, as he listened to the monks. The next day, the disciple asked Saint Daniel to tell him who that old man was, the one who was so compassionate and so hospitable. So the disciple goes to Elder Daniel, and the elder answered him, "His name, my child, is Eulogios. He is a stonecutter. He has no wife and no children. He has bound himself to this good practice, and he fasts the whole day long. And he works at such heavy labor, and whatever money they give him as his day's wage, he spends in the evening on hospitality, and not only on strangers but on the poor of the city as well. That is the work he does. And although he is advanced in years, God gives him all the greater strength because his heart is so full of love for the poor. He performs this extremely heavy labor and has kept this rule since his youth. I have known him for 40 years. 40 years ago, when I used to come here as a young man to sell my handiwork, he often offered hospitality to me and to other poor people as well, in the very way you have now seen. When I saw such compassion in him, I prayed for him. Daniel saw how much good this man was doing, and what did he do then? He thought he should remind God of something. This man earned one day's wage and offered the whole of it as a sacrifice. Why should this man not have abundant wealth, so that he may do even more good and your name may be glorified?" This was a right-hand thought, a seemingly righteous thought, yet Daniel was indirectly accusing God of injustice, as though God were wrong to leave Eulogios struggling for a daily wage when he could have given away great wealth. So Daniel made a vow. Listen to what kind of vow he made. For many weeks he kept a strict fast, praying with tears that God would give Eulogios wealth, so that he could offer hospitality to even more poor people. After 20 days had passed and his request had still not been granted, the elder continued pleading. Exhausted by hunger, he collapsed, but he would not abandon his petition. Then he saw a glorious young man appear and ask him why he was fasting. I made a promise to Christ our Master that I would eat nothing at all until he heard my prayer and made Eulogius rich so that he could do still more good for the poor. Lord and Master, I said, I will not break my fast unless you give him money. Then the one who appeared said, Why are you so concerned about Eulogius? I answered him, so that through him your holy name may be glorified. That is my concern. If you want me to give him wealth, then become the guarantor for his soul that in this way he will be saved and I will do as you desire. Will you stand surety to me for his soul without thinking I made the promise, saying, I take the debt upon myself, I will answer for his soul at the hour of judgment. As I heard these words, it seemed to me that we were in the church of the holy resurrection of Christ. In this vision, I saw a young man seated upon the stone of Christ's tomb, with Eulogius standing at his right hand. The young man appeared as an angel, but he was Christ himself. Then the young man who had appeared said, Are you the one who stood surety for Eulogius? They said, Yes, Lord. This is the one who went surety for him. And I said, Yes, Lord. And then I see two young men. They came and filled the fold of Eulogius' garment with silver coins. So when I woke up from all this, I understood that God had heard my prayer, because a few days later it was fulfilled. That is, it came to pass. What happened? While Eulogius was cutting stones as he always did, he struck one stone and heard a sound underneath it, and around it he found a hollow space full of pure gold, 24 karat gold. He had never seen so much wealth. He began wondering what to do with it and where to hide it, not where to spend it. Another thought told him, God will enlighten you and show you what to do. He had only just seen the gold. He had not yet gathered it into sacks or carried it away. He did not know how he should spend it or where he could conceal it. So he decided to move to Byzantium. The thought was carried out at once. He gathers up his money, loads it up, and sets off for Constantinople to stay unknown to the very end, far away from those poor, those suffering, those wounded. That was when he gave up hospitality. He took all the money and arrived in Constantinople. He gave many gifts, and they made him eparch, the city prefect, a great position in Constantinople, and all of it because of the money. He bought a large and luxurious house. He became a man weighed down with cares, with much glory and a great deal of show. He forgot it all completely, the hospitality he had shown before, and his humility. So God did not want to give him a lot of money. That was the reason, because you can't change a person all at once. But the other man had made himself his guarantor. Give him money too. It was a thought from the right-hand side, the kind of temptation that comes dressed up as something good, to put God to the test. He thinks he knows better than God, and he wants to see whether Eulogius would do an even greater work of charity. 2 years later, I again saw in a vision that same young man. I saw him say, Bring Eulogius, the one for whom you became guarantor. Then a dark figure appeared, bringing Eulogius bound. It was the devil bringing him. This was the new vision I saw. I woke up, and I understood what that vision meant. And I wept, saying, Woe is me! I have brought punishment on my own soul by the pledge I gave, fool that I was. From then on, whenever I went down to the market to sell my handiwork, I would ask after Eulogius. Where is Eulogius? What has become of him now? I learned that he had been spending large sums. I did not yet know that he had found the money and had gone off to Constantinople, when I learned the truth. With much toil and hardship, I made my way to Constantinople, where I kept making careful inquiries about Eulogius. So now I was searching through the city to find him. I found his house, and as I stood outside the door, I saw him coming out with a retinue of countless servants and pomp beyond anything I could have imagined. So I called out to him and waved to him. I beg you, give me just a moment to hear me out, so I can tell you something in private. There's something I need to say to you. But he gave no answer, while his attendants and servants beat me, insulted me, and drove me away. I remained outside his palace for 4 weeks without being able to speak to him at all. There was no way even to approach him, so I fell down before the holy icon of the Lord and pleaded with tears, O Master, Rich in mercy, release me from the guarantee I gave for this man, otherwise I shall return to the world. I shall even abandon the monastic life and go back into the world. I beseech you." After I had prayed like this many times, I fell asleep from sheer exhaustion, and in my sleep I see a great crowd of people, and I hear a voice saying to me, "The queen is coming. Come, all of you, and venerate her." Then I cried out to her, "O lady and intercessor, have mercy on me, and release me from the pledge, the surety I gave for Eulogius." But she answered me, "I cannot help you in this matter. You must see your own case through to the end yourself." Then I woke up, and I found myself once more at the gateway. And when Eulogius came out, I ran after him, crying out for him to give me a hearing. But the doorkeeper ran at me and beat me so severely that I was left half dead. Then I departed. As soon as I was able, I boarded a ship and set out for the Sket, placing my hope in God that he would restore Eulogius. So while we were sailing to Alexandria, I fell asleep, and once again I saw in my vision that I was standing in the Church of the Holy Resurrection, the Anastasis, and that young man I told you about was sitting on the stone of the tomb, and again he said to me, "Look at you, you wild and senseless man, you did not carry out what you promised." I trembled like a leaf from fear and could not open my mouth. Then he ordered them to bind my hands behind my back and hang me like a condemned man. "Why did you wish to appear more righteous than I and make Eulogios rich? Learn through this punishment never again to attempt anything beyond what I ordain." So while the servants had me hanging there, I saw the Queen of the Angels passing by in glory beyond all describing, and to her I said, in a humble voice and with tears, "Have compassion on me, Sovereign Lady, wretched as I am, and free me from the pledge of surety I gave for Eulogios." Then she went over to him, and after kissing the feet of the Master, she begged him to forgive me my sin, and the Master, for the sake of his mother's supplication, the mother's prayer to the Master has great power, heard her plea and granted it. He released me, saying, "Take heed that you never again commit such a sin." I said to him, "Forgive me, Master, for I sinned in ignorance. I thought that Eulogios would become more compassionate toward the poor." Then he commanded that they release me, and with great tenderness he said to me, "Go to your cell, and I will restore Eulogios to his former station and reverence." When I heard this, I woke up for sheer joy, and I glorified the Lord and the all-holy Theotokos, because they had delivered me from the surety I had pledged for him and from the punishment that was awaiting me. 3 months later, the providence of God went to work to rescue Eulogios. The Emperor Justin died, and Justinian came to the throne. They came to hate Eulogios so much that, in order to escape death and save his life, he put on shabby clothes, abandoned his wealth, fled in secret to Alexandria, and began cutting stones again to make a living. With the money he earned, he reopened his lodging house for the poor. In this way, the two men met again, spoke together, and discussed all that had happened. Daniel revealed to him, "I took responsibility for your soul because I entertained the thought that God was being unjust by not giving you wealth, and that if he gave it to you, you would become better. Instead, you became worse." My beloved, let us stop here for tonight. Let each of us reflect upon the different forms taken by these right-hand thoughts, these seemingly good thoughts that deceive us.